The court will move on to the fourth case of the day, United States against Hopkins.
May it please this honorable court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is Carl Clavelli. I represent John Hopkins in this appeal from his sentencing. Mr. Hopkins had a written plea agreement, the parties were well aware that he was serving a sentence in Indiana, a state sentence, which came from a robbery which took place a month or two after the federal bank robbery. The situation which is presented in this case, which the district judge apparently was not sensitive to, is that frequently people are sentenced, and because of arbitrary matters, like maybe if a person robbed a bank in Illinois and then a bank across the line in Indiana, they might have two indictments.
But Mr. Clavelli, I just want to find out whether you're really saying that the district court judge here just made a mistake in the way the guidelines themselves were applied, kind of, I'll call it an old-fashioned pre-Booker kind of mistake, or whether you're saying something more broad about the state, about the sentence the district
I believe there are two mistakes, Your Honor. And the first mistake is that we don't have the total punishment computed under the guidelines. So we never get to the point of what would be the presumptively reasonable sentence.
Why not?
Well, I have a theory on that.
You're talking about grouping these?
Yes.
I always thought that grouping is just for the federal offenses.
Well, that's the problem.
Other robbery. Your example you started off was a bank robbery in Indiana,
yes.
And assuming they're federally insured, those would be federal offenses.
Yes, and there's another example too, because the robbery could be a state robbery. So you could have a state indictment and a federal indictment, or you could have two federal indictments in different courthouses. It shouldn't matter. According to 3553A6. The purpose of the guidelines, the congressional purpose, is to avoid unwarranted disparities. If you read 5G1.3C, to give a district judge discretion to sentence a defendant serving an undischarged term of imprisonment to a partially concurrent, fully concurrent, or fully consecutive sentence without any linking to what the total punishment under the guidelines would be, there's no point in having guidelines.
But I want to be sure I understand what you're saying, that as a matter of law, when there is a state conviction or a state charge, I'll just call it, and a federal charge, before you can come up with, and somebody's now serving some time in the state charge, the district judge is obliged to go through a long hypothetical computation of what would this charge have, the state charge have been if it had been in the same indictment, and how would the grouping rules hypothetically have operated, and then hypothetically how would you come up with some final number? Because I don't know of any case that says that.
Well, I believe that is the case, Judge, but it's not hypothetical.
What case has read the guidelines that way? Because, of course, it was a state. That's your whole problem, actually. It was a state conviction.
But if it was a federal bank robbery, we still would have been dealing with 3D1.5.
But it wasn't, though. I mean, so why do you even get to the grouping point? Why isn't the judge entitled, as a matter of discretion,
for this reason,
to take
Judge,
into account this other?
For this reason. Let's say that the guideline sentence on one bank robbery would be 7 years, and on the other bank robbery would also be 7 years. They're both figured under the guidelines. Well, if you run them consecutively, that's 14 years. That's not a reasonably incremental sentence. That is doubling the sentence. That is an arbitrary disparity.
You don't think a judge could do that in the post-Booker world?
Only with reasonable basis. Now we go back to the cross and the angle tests. You have to find out what the guideline total punishment should be, and it's easy to do. It's not hypothetical.
No, but it is hypothetical. Look, you have this state robbery, and it's not charged in the federal indictment.
True.
And so we don't get to the point that you want us to get to. Or at least you haven't shown me where under the guidelines the judge is obliged to do that, other than, you know, because you've pointed to 5G 1.3, but that's not so unequivocal.
Well, 5G 1.2b says, with an eye towards 3553A, compute the total punishment. You can't ignore that. And it says you should use the grouping chapter 3. Example 1 in 3D1.5 is a series of bank robberies. They are grouped in separate groups.
But as Judge Evans said, those are all federal offenses. Where do you get over to the state offenses?
The guideline system cannot work if you are going to separate federal from state and federal from federal. You have to look at an individual as an individual who is being sentenced, as the Supreme Court said in the Witt, as if it was all in one sentencing. It's not hypothetical, Your Honor. The system cannot work if you don't consider what the guideline sentence would be if everything was together. And it's not hard to do.
Well, if your argument is right, then, if you have somebody who is, say, convicted and serving, a 30-year state sentence and now is in federal court pleading to something that under the guidelines is 18 months or something, he would have to get a concurrent sentence. Absolutely, the judge would have no authority to do anything else, right? Isn't that the logical end of your argument?
I believe if I understand the question, the answer would be yes.
So he gets, in effect, no additional penalty for committing a federal offense.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that the thinking would be a little differently. The thinking would be that if you were to put the state case and sentence in the guidelines, it would be much higher than the guidelines would call for. And so because the state sentence was twice as high as it would have been under the guidelines, you just say, well, we have to get some time. We're going to add on to it. Well, that's an unwarranted disparity. So if every state did that and every federal judge did that, we would have the system that existed pre-1987, pre-guidelines. The guideline system is broad. I fought it for many years, but now I understand it, and it's meant to bring all these factors into play. And if the factors are brought in,
it's very hard to understand the whole guideline system.
It's taken me a long time.
The second case we had today was somebody with a little crack cocaine. He got life in prison. Here you got a bank robbery, which I think is a lot more serious.
Yes.
He gets 71 months.
But if you get two bank robberies under the federal guidelines, you're talking about 87 months maximum, and my client got 113 months.
It's different sovereigns.
True, but not a good reason, in my opinion, to overlook the congressional intent.
It's a reason, but whether it has to be a good reason or not is, I don't know if that's important under the guidelines.
Your Honor, in my opinion, the reason the guidelines exist is because it was embarrassing to go in front of one judge and get probation, and on the same case, go in front of another judge and get 5 years.
Well, sure.
That's why we have the guidelines.
That's what happened. I was a district judge before the guidelines, and it was a wonderful world at that time. And then Ted Kennedy and Strom Thurmond got together, and they looked at prisons, and Kennedy felt sorry for the guy who was doing 10 years when somebody else was doing 2, and Thurmond felt that the guy doing 2 was getting an unreasonable break, so he wanted him to get 10. So they had some sort of a compromise here, and we ended up with the guidelines.
That's correct, but the alternative is it promotes disrespect for the system when we have this luck of the draw. The guidelines are used to eliminate that. Thank you, Judge.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. X?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles X. I represent the government. Mr. Clavelli is basically asking you to impose this hypothetical methodology on 5G 1.3 when it simply does not exist. There was at one time, pre-1995, 5G 1.3C had a suggestion that that is something that the sentencing court could consider, but it was never, even pre-1995, a mandatory requirement. And once 5G 1.C was amended in 1995, that hypothetical calculation was entirely written out by the Sentencing Commission. And I would submit that it was written out for a very good reason, because it was unwieldy and didn't really make a lot of sense. And for one of the reasons that I think Judge Evans has already pointed out, you know, you have a sovereign in the state of Indiana that is imposing one sentence, and the federal sentence is being dictated by the guidelines in an entirely different arena.
Do you think, Mr. X, I don't think this argument's really before us, but in the post-Booker world, do you think what I'll call these federalism-related adjustments are within the discretion of the district court judge in fashioning a reasonable sentence?
I mean,
of course, we know you start by computing. We've made this pretty clear. Start by computing the number under the guidelines. Let's assume it's this number. But the judge might then say, let me step back a minute, and I realize there are these other things going on. I'm going to change the number.
Yes, I think under the Booker world that we live in now, the test is a reasonableness. And I think that if you look at how 5G 1.3C is structured, it is one of the areas, I think, in the guidelines that actually is consistent with the post-Booker world as it existed pre-Booker, because it gave complete discretion to the court to look at a variety of discretionary type factors. And among those are the factors that Mr. Clovelly alluded to, which was factors under 3553A, as well as some of the other related factors, which, in fact, in this case, I think it's really clear that Judge Lindberg actually did look at all those factors. He did exercise his discretion, and one of the things that he came up with that in fashioning his sentence was Mr. Hopkins' criminal history essentially was understated, underrepresented his criminality, and there's absolutely nothing in the record that could contradict that finding, in the sense that if you look, and it's in the PSR, and as we've laid out in our brief, I don't want to rehash that.
The judge ran through quite a bit of
yes,
it, actually.
Yes, he did. Yes, and I think if you just look at that, that in itself shows the reasonableness, both under Booker and under 5G 1.3C itself, as to why this sentence was a reasonable and not an abuse of discretion in any way, shape, or form. Unless the court has any further questions, I would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's sentence in this matter.
All right, apparently not. So thank you very much, Mr. X. Mr. Clovelly.
Just briefly, Your Honor, on that last point. The judge did abuse his discretion by, even though he went through a litany of the arrest record, if my client had gotten a point for every misdemeanor that he was convicted of, he still would have been in criminal history category 4. The judge utilized arrests. Under 4A1.3, he abused his discretion when he took the arrest record and said, well, you know, he's no choir boy and all that, and I don't see any reason to give him a break. He obviously punished him for his arrest record. It cannot be avoided by the comments he made and then the sentence he rendered. And so I believe, Your Honor, that he violated not only the structure of the guideline by failing to link his departure to the tests of cross and angle. He also violated the spirit when he said, I'm going to look at the arrest record. And he made it clear that he did, Judge. Thank you.
Yes. And Mr. Flavelli, you were appointed, were you not?
Yes.
We thank you very much for your fine assistance to your client. Thank you also to the government. We'll take the case under advisement.